Small clarification. I mean, you're giving all examples from cinema largely, and you're saying the network is more sort of all the participants are on same level, or each node is a peer. But that's a very idealistic imagination of the network, no? I mean, Shuddha can pull the plug when he wants to, or like, is like, you know, who has the right to the password and their sense of judgment. And then all the things you're extrapolating, you're giving like examples of cinema, like your Schadenfreude model is when you watched the Ram Gopal's Aag is again a so you could be that watching a film, and it's not a digital network platform.
What I'm suggesting to you is that the Schadenfreude allows you to question the spectatorial position, which is otherwise a relationship with a frame and a body, and the complicit nature by which the body produces a normative self. The Schadenfreude position becomes much more interesting in the case of a network, because the network allows for not a passive spectatorial position or an active user position, but somewhere in between where you are lurker, and you are a part of the spectacle, and the spectacle is in many ways created for you in many.
So how is it absent in the in say cinema? But you, when you're given an example, you can be that while consuming cinema, is this vast audience which decided not to watch it, or just laughed at the posters, or you know what I mean? Like, or went to watch it and is not voicing their thing necessarily, but like taking pleasure in its.
I'm not sure what is it that you're contradicting.
No, I'm saying like you're giving you're talking about the networked model on the digital platform.
Okay.
But then everything else is also the theories you're attributing it is already happening in that non-digital platform.
Yeah, but
also.
I'm not saying that it is a new thing which has come up only with digital platforms. I'm tracing a very strong continuity of spectatorial positions which have transformed from one to another. Traditionally, as far as I know, and my reading of film theory is not really very extensive, but the spectator has been designed as subject to the frame in certain ways.
The network decides. We didn't want the disruptions of the Kashmiri Pandits, right? It was going very well for a long time, and
right.
it wasn't imagined, right? So it's like everybody goes with an assumption like we are all going to be a certain peers, or like, you know, or like, this is my audience, and there's always disrupt people outside it. For, I mean, how is it different? What is the critical difference?
I don't want to stop what is perhaps an extremely compelling discussion. It's just that I don't understand it. And I notice that there's not a lot of engagement. I mean, we don't want to get into details about specific cases. I think the point that this challenges the constitution of a normative subjectivity has been amply made. Maybe someone else would like to challenge that.
It's fine. Would catharsis end the network then? I mean, if one was to end the network. Because catharsis at the end of the day is about the coming to an end of a network of relationships, because whatever is producing the normative self is resolved. So there's no need for a network if catharsis happens. In fact, all networks are, at the end of the day, like in Shuddha's reading list, for example. It's a network as long as catharsis doesn't happen on one side or the other. As long as one side doesn't give in, the network is on. The moment catharsis happens on one side, the network is off. I mean, that's my problem with network theory, that at the end, it's always about an aim, and if catharsis happens around that goal, the network is finished.
I'm not so sure. Simply because the network does not have a one single point frame of reference, and that there is not only a one, let's say the Kashmiri Pandits debate, if everybody is happy, that's not the end of the reader's list. Because there is not only one source of information feeding into the network, that there are many different autonomous subgroups and so on, and the ability of the network to travel beyond a frame of reference is what's interesting. I'm not really very sure if I agree with the fact that catharsis is the end of a particular or a resolution of any sort.
Yeah.
So catharsis is actually only an emotional engagement with a certain action, which then leads to further complications or bifurcations.
Well, I mean, if going by cinema history, for example, I mean, if you were to talk about The Lurker, so we look at New Wave, which has a completely voyeuristic relationship with American cinema and has a huge theory about how voyeurism is at the center of producing a certain kind of cinema. But the problem is that a certain network develops around that lurkers. A number of lurkers get together and decide to make cinema. At the end of the day, there is a catharsis which ends the movement and the network. I mean, so are we talking about an infinite regression of people working out a certain kind of illumination of the world, so as to say, like, you know, that various people are in various circumstances of circumscription, and a network is produced in order to get people out of that circumscription, and catharsis is a moment when people realize, oh, this is my world, I now am in control of the world that was within me. And therefore the normative selves, the logic which was actually stopping me from being myself rather than being a normative self, and I think there's a difference there, is why this network was all about. I was on Facebook as long as I didn't know myself. And so, I mean, I'm saying that, you know, the logic of the network somewhere has this logic of self-discovery and catharsis and things like that. And it then infinitely produces one network after the other, which goes back to the same question again and again. You know what I mean? And that's why at some point scientific network theories have always failed, because the basic question of what scientific inquiries is all about gets lost within the logic of the networks, and certain questions stop getting asked. And that's where the critique of Latour's ANT comes in from. I mean, I'm just talking about that, yeah.
Can you just explain a little bit more why is it, from what I can understand, the notion that the circumspection that is caused by narrative, for example, the cinematic frame, is that there's a narrative. And there will be a beginning and end, and the relationship with catharsis is also towards kind of closure from the outside, because the narrative comes to an end, the play, the whatever, there is that moment. And so whatever happens post-catharsis is very, is not within the frame of the actual, but it's not within the frame that the film is providing. It is outside. It is spilled over into other, as we can say, like I might go home and think about the film more and have further discussion. That's a different thing. But the film and its narrative, or the play and its narrative, have given me that relationship with catharsis. Why do you say that this is the same thing with a network? Because precisely a network is not about a narrative. Yeah, it's not that there is no beginning, middle, and end. That is the precise function of, and that is why when you have a network with a multinodal scenario in which, as he's talked about very lucidly, there are various gradations of participation, whether you're a courier, facilitator, just, you know, or an act. But the point is that in any network, everyone is bringing in multiple tales. And once you have that, what is the notion of closure? Unless the closure is consensual. I mean, even though some Shuddha can say I can pull the plug, the point is you can pull a certain moment, but a new history will start. I mean, one can stop a certain moment.
That's all I'm saying. I'm saying that, A, that network theory is not outside. Well, let's face it. I mean, in some ways, people have been talking about network theories for ages in a different language. For say, for example, when Prop is doing an analysis of a fairy tale, he's talking exactly about a network. How does a fairy tale get produced? It gets produced when 6-7 people are produced. Exactly the same point he's making. There are 7-8 points which are equally important. So therefore the horse will become mythic because the horse is in the fairy tale. That horse is not an unequal participant in the narrative, because, and the prince and the horse and the helper, everybody is sacralized at exactly the same levels of, and the catharsis is precisely what gets at the end.
Yes.
Produces the closure of this network. That at the end, the horse becomes myth,
no,
the helper becomes myth, and things like that.
There's only closure of the network if the network's only intention for becoming the network is to make a myth, for example. That is why, you know, manifesto-led events often come to an end, because when you have no longer that moment of this is what we all agree on, things will collapse because there is a notion of a narrative within that. I'm saying when there is no notion of a narrative,
I don't agree that one can have that position that there is no narrative, and that is
where
the self-reflexivity comes in.
There is no one narrative.
In.
There are
yeah.
many, many, many yeah. narratives. There is no one, no, any discussion forum.
Yeah.
There's not one story. If something is set up only to discuss what's happening with this urban development project in Guwahati, then when it finishes, the the list will come to an end, and no matter how big or small a network it is, it will, it's found its moment of closure, because in whatever way is catharsis or not, the point is it's come to an end. But I'm trying really to understand how you were saying.
But then there is a fundamental problem which actor network theories run into, is that whether the node is more important or the network. Because you see, what's happening is that if we are looking at a network made up of nodes, which is a named network from your point of view, I can say that actually the network, the nodes are very important points where other networks are going into other elements. Now, that is where there is a contradiction between network and node, because these other elements and these other networks that are passing through nodes are actually aiming towards catharsis, which they will have in their own ways, in various ways. So then I'm always confused as to what is the relationship between this named network, which is the reader's list, and the other networks which are going through the nodes towards catharsis and have catharsis as the end point.
Notwithstanding that narratology actually has shown that there are almost no narratives that are completely linear, that they all have extraordinarily complex bifurcations. Leave that aside. It seems to me that, I don't know, it seems to me that the examples you're using of networks are online communities, are basically very closely linked to they're not metaphorical networks, they really aren't networks. But in an art world, is an art world a network? Or is it a community? This is a question.
I do know that there's one interesting thing that the network is doing to the spectatorial position is also that it does not expect a continuity in spectatorial positions, in terms that it is very easy to pull in and pull out. If there is a certain amount, let's say a certain group within a network which reaches a cathartic point, and for them the network becomes redundant, they can pull out of it and they can go into another space, but the network does not collapse because of that. In a narrative, the narrative is a finite point there, because the minute the entire spectatorial position has reached a moment of catharsis, you can now plug out and the narrative has officially ended. The narrative might now travel through different routes of conversation, of dialogue, of discourse, of meta-discourse, and so on, but the narrative itself has reached a finite point. So that spectatorial continuity, which is not expected out of the different kinds of, and I'm of the participants, or what I would prefer to call stakeholders, because I'm as skeptical of the network actors theory as you are. Because the network actor theory basically presumes that there is a certain kind of agential actor who enters into this named network or a false condition which has been created, performs a certain kind of tasks, and then reaches a certain point of culmination, which you are calling catharsis. So it's much more fruitful to understand the network as a combination of what they are calling hardware, software, and wetware, where the biological body is only a smaller component of what the entire network consists of. So that the network is also larger than the sum total of its constituent elements.
Now then, let's talk about the other problem then. Now then, if you're talking about the network not collapsing, now, the Indic caste system is precisely that kind of network. There are four names which are there, have remained so for thousands of years. Actors have come and gone through and through these positions. Absolutely, you know, one definition of who could be this character, a Shudra or a Kshatriya. The next generation has nothing to do with that looks or the values or the valor or anything of that kind, but they're inducted into the system. Now, then, if the network survives despite catharsis, that is also a problem, because then you are in the risk of becoming an institutionalized node like the caste system, where then as many numbers of players and actors and catharsis will pass through and the nodes remain there. I mean, there's a...
The caste system is characterized by a set of practices which a network never is.
Of course it is. It is not. The caste system is not at all. Historically, the caste system has not been... This is a rigidification of the actual history of caste. It has never been defined by any set of practices.
Which is exactly what I'm saying, that the caste in itself is not defined by practices, but a caste system, which is the institution of caste, is characterized by homogenized practices.
Absolutely not. Your caste system is your great network, what you're talking about. It is absolutely about that. It is the four names that will remain, and people can do anything within it and get away with anything. There is nothing homogeneous about the caste system in terms of its history, and that is one of the greatest examples to consider when you're thinking about networks, because this is something that I have, you know, looking at castes and the histories. I mean, one thing that comes through is that the resilience of the caste system is precisely because it positions itself precisely in these flexible terms, that people can come in, go out, and do whatever, and you know.
No, but I don't see a problem with that. I mean, networks can be horrible things. And there is no problem in my mind in seeing the fact that a network can be a pathological, dangerous, persistently bad thing, right? So, I mean, just because it is a network and not an institution, or just because it is a network that gradually morphs into an institution, doesn't mean that I do not recognize the fact. I mean, there is a certain degree of flexibility that networks provide us, but that flexibility can be as open to abuse as it is to anything else. So, I mean, I don't feel the need that we should enter into a defense of networks as a normative value.
No, I'm just saying that this debate is not relevant to this particular discussion, because the defense was not of networks, but of another caste discourse or a caste system discourse which exists in India. And we can talk about it.
No, I'm just producing the polarities of networks.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just to return to the idea of catharsis, because I think there's something interesting there. The question we could begin to ask is, whose catharsis? The Aristotelian model always presumes that the catharsis is of the spectator, that the catharsis is an event that occurs within the spectator's consciousness. We could equally argue that the catharsis is actually something that is produced within the performer's body. And I think that all of the experience of networks that we have had, and the Schadenfreude that you're talking about, is actually the chuckle at the performative excess of the cathartic moment of the performer.
Thank you. That was so more lucidly put than I had.
Which then produces a situation where people produce these catharses and then become lurkers for a while. And I think that the interesting thing about the lurker that emerges from this discussion is the enormous power that the lurker has, which every performer is aware of. Because the lurker is always a potential performer, which is the difference between spectatorialship in its somewhat abstracted understanding and what we know as lurking, because the whole point of lurking is that you're present and no one knows quite what you're going to do. You do not state your intentions, you do not present your agendas, you're just absorbing what's going on, and no one quite knows what you're going to do and when you're going to do it. And therefore, the question of agency and cathartic agency is actually something that we can think of in a more agile way than merely a question of, you know, a catharsis. So to come back to your question, tragedy is not necessarily only the stabilizing narrative that the demos will have to absorb in order to return to the task of tilling. What if the tragedy performed on stage is the substance of the comic relief of the masses, which is what often happens in networks, because people enter networks for very different reasons, for very different intentions. They enact very different moves, and those get interpreted not necessarily consensually. I mean, the interpretation that you are saying would be absolutely correct if there was a consensus between those watching and those performing. However, if they're at cross purposes, you know, the tragedy can be completely destabilizing.
I entirely agree with that, but I think it's important to bear in mind why tragedy was invented in the first place. I mean, put yourself in the place of the ruling class. They felt that the situation was threatening enough that they had to devise something as complex as representation. Now, their representation may be more complicated than they had in mind. It certainly is. And it has its internal dynamics. But they must have thought that there were lurkers not in the audience, because we're talking about a pre-audience moment, but there must have been lurkers in the populace who were liable to, as you say, perform their lurkerhood or their lurkiness by refusing to return to their laborious condition. And in that sense, that's why, I mean, I think that I would make is it legitimate then to draw a parallel between the lurker within a network and other forms of stealth agency, such as the spy?
I mean, the work of Vidal Naquet and Vernon, it's a very clear-cut thing that they're doing. They're taking up Nietzsche's idea, but they're saying that tragedy is invented at the moment of the momentous hoplite revolution, where the peasantry is brought in, hoplite revolution, where the peasantry is co-opted into the army, and that is the moment where tragedy is invented. Then there's a study of actually the young, the Ifib, who is trained to become a warrior. And Naquet does this great study called The Black Warrior, and he says that it's all about stealth, actually. All that the Greek warrior, the young warrior, is taught is about stealth, and their whole work on this notion of metis is about cunning. You see, it is stealth, yeah. It's about metis, and they study Ulysses as a character who actually has to actually undergo a logic of, you know, in some ways they kind of say that Ulysses could have been a regicide because he's so wise that he would see a tyrant and kill. But Ulysses will have to play all these games and will have to act naive in order to not kill the king, because he'll have to hide his intelligence, which would have told him to. So they do this series of studies which is to do with the constitution of the army. So it's not just that the Pierre Vidal Naquet and Jean-Pierre Vernon who do these studies of the tragedy. And so it's actually at the moment of the militarization of the peasantry that the tragedy is introduced into Greece, into Athens, because it makes sense in some ways that, you know, it has got to do with the Bacchanalia, and it's got to do with a certain sharing of power that the elite now have to do with a soldier who is willing to sacrifice their lives and livelihood for the demos. And therefore, that relationship with pleasure then becomes a very interesting logic. What does the soldier's relationship with pleasure is in a Bacchanalia and things like that? Which then leads to a modification of Nietzsche's theory, in that sense that it's not just a spectator, just an audience, but this is when the hoplite revolution has happened. That these are young boys who have gone to war, and now we must think about how to keep them in control, and how to kind of, you know, and that then, you know, gets into this logic of the lurker in your way, which all through what you've been saying, that's been running through my mind, that it, at the end of the day, it's about some kind of surveillance system against which you are defined as a lurker, in which you might define yourself as a lurker. So I would like to ask you, who defines the lurker? Is the person lurking who's defining? Because that's very crucial, because, you know.
Should they define me?
I think it's a really interesting question, because the understanding of tragedy that you propose, which is regicide, patricide, and all these things being terrible, horrible things that we must all learn from the hubris of the characters and so on, also flexes differently in different conditions. I mean, there is a tragic sensibility in Sanskrit drama where people are delighted at regicide. You know, the fact that the gods should behave so abominably is a question of which is why in the aesthetic categories here, the nine rasas, the juices that are supposed to flow in any encounter, one of the very important juices is disgust, which is somewhat close to Schadenfreude, where the fact that people, you know, I mean, which is something, I mean, I always think of this moment where the Nepalese prince, crown prince, you know, assassinated his entire family and then himself as a moment of great hilarity. Everyone enjoyed it. It was a tragedy. It was regicide. But the entire population of South Asia was delighted at this, you know, spectacular production of blood and gore in the palace. So it wasn't as, it wasn't even, there was no sadness at all in the, no sadness, no regret at this production. I mean, when, you know, routinely our leaders get assassinated, some people commit suicide, other people celebrate. It's, there isn't this kind of regretful, remorseful, reflective, distant sadness that gets produced at these spectacular events of violence.
So now should we close the parentheses and head for the dock?